From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After leading a platoon in Iraq for the U.S. National Guard, Paul Rykoff founded the group Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about his experiences in Iraq, where he says his platoon was under-equipped and insufficiently trained for their mission, and we talk about the needs of returning vets. Rykoff's experiences in Iraq led him to be critical of the Bush administration's leadership, but he's critical of Democrats as well and describes himself as an independent and his group as nonpartisan. He's written a new memoir called Chasing Ghosts. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Elements of Style, the first and last novel by the playwright Wendy Wasserstein, who died earlier this year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Paul Rykoff, is the founder and executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, IAVA. In 2003 and 2004, he was a first lieutenant leading an infantry platoon in Iraq for the U.S. Army National Guard. He's an advocate for the needs of the men and women in the military, as well as veterans, but he's critical of how the war has been handled by the Bush administration. After he returned home, he was invited to give the Democratic response to President Bush's weekly radio address on May 1, 2004, the first anniversary of the president's mission accomplished speech. Rykoff has been critical of Democrats as well as Republicans and describes himself as an independent. He's written a new book called Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington. He's now an infantry officer in the New York Army National Guard. Paul Rykoff, welcome to Fresh Air. When you came back home from Iraq, was there a void that you felt in terms of support for yourself as a veteran?
I don't think there was a void for supporting veterans like me. To be honest with you, when I came home, everybody was fantastic. And no matter how people felt about the war, they embraced me, they bought me beers, they welcomed me home, they shook my hand. And I think that's in large part a testament to the work that Vietnam veterans have done. They've taught this country to separate the war from the warriors. But I also saw that my perspective and the perspective of people like me wasn't involved in the national dialogue. You heard from Al Franken and you heard from Bill O'Reilly, but you very seldom heard from a sergeant who had been on the ground in Fallujah or a lieutenant who walked the streets of Ramadi. And they really understood the complexity of what was happening in Iraq, and they didn't have a partisan agenda. They weren't coming from a political standpoint or running for office. They were grunts who'd been on the ground, who were a lot like the son or daughter that you may have in your family or somebody down the street. That's what really bothered me, that those folks weren't really on television. They weren't on the radio, and they weren't writing enough about their experiences. So that was really a big part of what motivated us to create the group, was the need to inject that very credible and very important voice into the national dialogue about the number one issue facing America, which is the Iraq War.
You know, as you point out in your book, we now have an all-volunteer army, and you write that you think a lot of soldiers feel guilty about knowingly risking their lives to join the military and then go to Iraq because they know that this can have an effect not only on their life but on the lives of their families. And they can't say, well, you know, I was forced to do it, I was drafted. So is that something you thought about a lot when you were risking your life in Iraq, that there were people who you would be hurting if you were hurt?
I did think about it, especially on my way over to Iraq for the first time, where you had time to contemplate all your decisions and all your life. When you're in the mix on the ground in Iraq, you don't always have time or space to think about all these issues inside your head. But I did think about the fact that I volunteered for this. It wasn't something my government made me do. I didn't get a draft notice. I had other options. And when you volunteer to join the military, you're not just volunteering yourself, you are volunteering your family. So, you know, in a way, my girlfriend, my mom, my dad, my brother, they were all in this with me. And I think that's the piece of this war that's often forgotten. The entire year I was in Iraq, you know, my family's on pins and needles watching the news or not. My mother sold her television the week I left for Iraq because she didn't want to know what was going on over there. She wanted to keep it out of her mind as much as possible. So I think that there is a bit of guilt that comes into at least my mind when I think about my decision to join. And I know fathers and mothers go through the same type of contemplation, thinking about, you know, what they're really getting their family into when they decide to do this.
You opposed the war. You've opposed it all along. You opposed it when you went to Iraq, but you went anyways. Do you consider your veterans group to be anti-war?
No, we're not at all an anti-war group, and I really don't consider myself in opposition of the war. I think, you know, I didn't think the war was a good idea going in, but that doesn't mean there's an easy solution now. I think the problem in this country in large part is that we've fallen into a false choice. It's not a very black and white dynamic. Our only options are not stay the course and be with George Bush or bring him home now and get with Cindy Sheehan. You know, I didn't agree with the rationale for war. I'm obviously upset that there were no weapons of mass destruction. I think we've done this war incredibly badly. But I don't think there's an easy solution and we can just pull them out right now. I think that's really what I want to communicate to people when I talk about the war, is that there are no easy answers. If we stay, it's going to be bad. We leave, it's going to be bad. And I think that's a much more complex situation than we've seen in the past and that we saw in Vietnam. So what I'm really working to try to do is get people past the anti and pro-war argument. I think that's why you haven't seen anti-war protests at the high levels you saw after Vietnam. I think that's why the discussion has really been polarized, because we haven't gotten into the meat meat of the third and fourth and fifth options that we can propose that aren't just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, but are really coming up with creative solutions that can make an immediate impact. So, you know, when we talk about opposing the war, I don't consider myself speaking out against the war. I'm speaking out about the war, and I'm going to lay out my opinions and my experiences and let people decide for themselves what they feel about this war.
But do you think of your group as being a political group?
I think so. I mean, Clausewitz once said that war is the extension of politics by other means. So when you send a million people to war, it becomes political. And it's hard to separate veterans' benefits from deployments. You know, we have to look at the troop numbers because they're going to impact the number of people coming home to the VA. And the VA is busting at the seams as it is. It's underfunded by close to $3 billion. So, you know, veterans' issues and the discussion of the war must be political. And what I am upset about is the way it's been thrown around like a political football, especially between the two parties, especially in 2004 when I first came into the public sphere. You know, John Kerry and George Bush were throwing it back and forth like a chew toy, and neither one of them was really getting into the dirt or getting into the nitty-gritty discussion about what we can do to change it. And I think that when it comes to the political parties in this country, guys like me are without a party. The Republicans got us into this mess, and the Democrats don't have a plan to get us out. And I think we see among our membership that they're very independent-minded, and I think they're really disgusted with both sides of the political dynamic right now and looking for a third way and looking for new options.
Now, you officially are an independent. You're registered independent, but you did give a Democratic address back on May 1st, 2004, on the first anniversary of the mission accomplished speech that George Bush, you know, the President Bush gave. And so you gave like the Democratic answer to his radio address on Saturday, May 1st, 2004. One of the things you said in your radio address was this: when we got to Baghdad, we soon found out that the people who planned this war were not ready for us. There were not enough vehicles, not enough ammunition, not enough medical supplies, not enough water. And you write in your book about how in your platoon there was not enough water. You sometimes had one bottle a day per person. And so as the leader of that platoon, what did you try to do? Like, what was in your power to do to try to get more water?
We got creative. There's an old saying in the military: adapt, improvise, and overcome. And thankfully, I had some non-commissioned officers and soldiers in my platoon who were creative. And they, you know, raided Air Force bases in the rear where they could find pallets of water. And they tried to buy water from the local community if it was safe, and they determined it was drinkable. And, you know, we limited our water intake and really rationed. I think that, you know, the water story is an excellent example of how the planning failed, guys like me on the ground. When we got to Baghdad, there wasn't a plan to secure the peace. You know, we all kind of looked at each other and said, okay, do we go home now? And they said, no, you're going to stay here for a few months. Well, we were jumping into a world that we really weren't prepared for. We didn't have interpreters. We didn't have an understanding of the culture. We definitely didn't have enough troops to control the area we were assigned to. So we really felt like we were out on an island. And I think the water is one example, but it goes all the way up to our policy and understanding how difficult it was for the soldiers on the ground to try to figure it out. You know, Rumsfeld and President Bush really didn't give us direction on how to deal with the looting. We really didn't understand how to build the Iraqi army up or that the police were going to be gone. So, you know, the soldiers on the ground, I think, have done a tremendous job of trying to make the most out of what they were given. But I think at the same time, we have to understand there needs to be accountability for these failures, because it shouldn't just be the soldier on the ground who gets shot or gets wounded who pays the price.
What kind of accountability would you like to see?
I think it starts at the top. I think the president needs to admit that there have been mistakes and fire somebody, whether it's Rumsfeld or somebody else within the Department of Defense. When I was a platoon leader, I was always taught that I was responsible for everything my unit did and everything they failed to do. If one of the guys in my platoon screwed up, it was my fault. So the Department of Defense and Rumsfeld need to take the same level of accountability. There have been numerous failures from the flaws in planning to Abu Ghraib, and the only people that have really suffered have been the lower-level people. So there needs to be some level of accountability that sends a message, not only to the military, but to people around the world, that failure and these miscues are really not accepted within the military or within America.
You mentioned that there were not enough troops, that you didn't have enough men to secure the area that you were responsible for. Now, this is a theme that we've heard throughout the criticisms of how the war has been planned. Would you give us a sense, like on the ground, what it meant for you to not have enough troops? Give us a sense of what you were assigned and the difficulties that you had because you didn't have enough men.
Sure. When we first got to Baghdad, we climbed the roof of the Ministry of Finance building with one of my sniper teams. We looked over the city, and one of my soldiers turned to me and said, "Hey, sir, where the hell is everybody else?" We had this huge landscape of area to control with 38 guys. The way I try to explain it to people is, imagine if you took 3/4 of the New York City Police Department off the streets tomorrow. The workload for that quarter that remained would be tremendous. They'd be running all over the place trying to secure the peace and maintain a level of order. That's what we saw in Iraq. We had Medical City, which was this huge medical complex where people were wounded coming in every day. With only 38 guys, we could only pick one section of that hospital to secure. So we picked the ER. We picked the emergency room. That meant that the wards where people were stacked up who were wounded or injured were left unsecure. It meant the morgue was left unsecure. It meant that the ambulances coming in weren't checked for bombs or grenades. Or insurgents. We just had to pick our spots and try to prioritize, and at the same time, try to cover our own butts when we really felt like we were running around with a target on our back. So I think it just ends up being a tremendous number of tasks for a very small number of people, and we get overextended, we get exhausted, and we're less effective.
Now, another criticism that you have, and this is another criticism I've heard from some other soldiers too, is that the best trained soldiers are not designed to be humanitarians, yet that's what the American people expected them to be in Iraq, is what you write. What were some of the humanitarian parts of the mission that you feel that you and your men weren't trained for, and what were the problems you had with your men because they weren't trained for it?
How to fix an electrical grid. We were taught in the Army, really, how to break things and blow things up. Kill people, break things, blow them up. That's what an infantry soldier is trained to do. I didn't know how to get the water system up and running in our area in Baghdad called Adamiya. I didn't know how to fix the electricity in the hospital. I went in and tried to work with the teachers to disseminate good information and education to the local kids, but I don't know how to get school books. I can't even get the medical aid because the Red Cross hasn't come and our medical units can't take care of all the people who were hurt. So, we weren't really trained in even how to talk to the Iraqi people. I didn't have an interpreter who spoke Arabic. I had to hire one from the local community. So it made every bit of communication difficult. And at the end of the day, soldiers are not always well-versed in the escalation of force that is sometimes necessary to secure the peace, knowing when to shoot and when not to shoot. We were always really trained for a linear battlefield somewhere in Europe against a Soviet enemy. They really hadn't taught soldiers how to walk in these complex environments and deal with the soft skills that are necessary in order to win over the American people, win over the Iraqi people, and win over their hearts and minds.
One of the things that you felt you were undersupplied with when you were in Iraq was body armor, and some of the men in your platoon ended up buying it themselves, or families would buy it and send it to them. I think there's legislation pending now that you support that's trying to address that in some way.
Absolutely. When I was in Iraq, my platoon had inadequate body armor. We had the old stuff that wouldn't stop an AK-47 round. And back home, I heard politicians saying everybody's got everything they need. So when I came home, body armor was a big issue for us. 40,000 troops approximately went into Operation Iraqi Freedom without adequate updated body armor, and that's unacceptable. So when I got home, one of the big issues for IAVA was to lobby and bring attention to the fact that everybody didn't have body armor. So toward the end of 2004, the Department of Defense said that there was body armor for every soldier, and I think that's due in part to our push in the media and getting veterans out there to tell their stories. That's a good example of how we were able to make a difference and try to reconcile something that had been bad. And then a few months later, Senator Dodd from Connecticut introduced the Equipment Reimbursement Act, which would provide over $1,000 reimbursement to any troop who had to pay out of pocket for sunglasses, body armor, or any other protective equipment. So I think, that piece of legislation is a good example of how veterans can lobby to take care of their own and bring the fight to Washington to try to improve the standard of living and improve the survivability for the people on the ground. And if soldiers hadn't done it, if veterans hadn't done it, it definitely would have taken longer.
My guest is Paul Rykoff, founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Rykoff. He's the author of the new memoir, Chasing Ghosts, and he's the founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. You write a little bit about what it's like to be a soldier when a lot of the people doing the work in Iraq are private military contractors. The feeling I got from what you were saying is that there was a certain degree of friction between the soldiers and the private military contractors. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's definite friction down to the lowest levels. You know, if I have a young soldier who's driving a truck and he's 19 years old from Alabama, he probably makes around $20,000 a year. If there's a Halliburton truck driver in the same compound doing essentially the same job, he's probably making $100,000 to do exactly the same thing. It's demoralizing for that soldier. And in addition, you know, we're less effective because these contractors are on the battlefield. If the firefights get heavy and the danger increases, these guys can pack it up and go home. They can quit. And they also don't answer to the same chain of command that we do. So, you know, for example, that there was a military contracting unit that operated throughout Baghdad that was kind of like a special ops unit. They wore black. They didn't have marked uniforms. They didn't have marked vehicles. And the local Iraqis called them Black Death. They were, you know, brutal. They were effective, I guess, militarily, but they didn't answer to the same chain of command that my soldiers and I did. So it sends a dangerous message to the Iraqi people. Who are these guys? We didn't know. And the Iraqis thought they were all Americans. So I think it really causes a serious lack of continuity on the battlefield. And it's definitely demoralizing to that average soldier who feels like, in the end of the day, his country really doesn't value him as much as it values a Halliburton contractor.
So, what kind of direct contact did you have with workers from Halliburton and other military contractors?
One example was they delivered our food. We were told for months that when Halliburton and KBR came in, our food was going to be awesome. We were going to get great food and morale was going to increase. Well, the food stunk. But beyond that, they were responsible for bringing us our food to our kind of remote compound in Baghdad every day. So if there was an attack on a convoy and a Halliburton truck driver quit, our eggs didn't come that day. Our pancakes didn't come that day. So we saw an immediate impact in just the deliverable services that were coming to us on the ground. In addition, we ran checkpoints throughout the city. And when contractors would come through, these guys didn't abide by the same rules, and they would literally try to blow us off. They'd say, you guys, I work for somebody higher than you. I don't have to tell you my name. I don't answer to your chain of command. You need to let me through this checkpoint. And my soldiers were saying, well, look, I don't know who you are. I can't verify your identity. You're not going through my checkpoint. So we'd have these standoffs with contractors where they're trying to do essentially what they want or need to do, and we're trying to do our jobs as well. And there's a terrible level of communication between the two. And when you hear about situations like Abu Ghraib and others, it's easy to understand how the lines are blurred and how miscommunications can occur and mistakes can prove catastrophic.
Do you think that the opinion you're expressing was shared by a lot of the men you worked with?
Absolutely. I haven't talked to many soldiers who think contractors are a good idea. And you know, it's obviously an opportunity for soldiers. I know a few guys who've gone back, and I was offered a position to go back for over six figures and work as a contractor. But I think, you know, it may be a better situation for the people immediately involved. You can improve your standard of living for you and your family. You can make a lot of money. But for our country and for our military, this is setting a dangerous precedent that I really think needs further examination. And if Congress can have hearings on whether or not baseball players are using steroids, I think we can have congressional hearings into the role of contractors in Iraq.
It seems from your book that the experience in Iraq that was most fulfilling to you as a soldier was your experience with some Iraqi children, particularly in a school that your platoon more or less adopted. Tell us about your school and the relationship that you developed with it.
There was a little school at the end of an alley that we called Little Mogadishu, referencing Black Hawk Down, the movie. It was run down. It looked kind of like a bombed out housing project. And there was a small school at the bottom of it, at the bottom of that alley, that was the local elementary school. And there were a few hundred kids that would go to school there. And they had been shot at by snipers intending to try to shut the school down and disrupt their education, I guess, and send a message to the local community. They hadn't been paid in weeks. The teachers hadn't been paid in weeks. And they had no material. materials, no books, no pencils, anything. So my platoon was able to go down there and eliminate the sniper threat. We were able to provide security and keep the school open. The guys in my platoon actually went into their own pockets and pulled together a few hundred dollars to give to the teachers so they could keep the school open, so they could pay their rent, and they could keep teaching the kids. And then they organized a campaign to write letters home and have binders and pencils and papers sent from Walmart and sent from their families back home to try to give them materials to keep the school open. And those types of instances are really the shining light for the guys who are over there. You try to make a difference on the ground, at least with a few kids, so you have something you can hang your hat on and try to claim some success.
And you're right that you were thinking winning over the kids is really important because they're the future. If the kids grow up hating Americans, we're in trouble.
Absolutely. I mean, the future of Iraq is under 18. These young kids are watching our every move, are monitoring the occupation, are seeing how we act. And if they don't like us, they're going to go to the other side. They're going to go to Al-Qaeda. They're going to go to the insurgency, and they're going to try to get us out of our country, out of their country. So, you know, the children on the ground are really the ones that we have to win over if we want to succeed in Iraq. And I think that starts with showing them a better way of life, showing them that our way is better than the alternative. And that starts with security. And until we can keep those kids safe, until we can make sure a mortar doesn't go off in their backyard or they don't get shot on the way to school, we're going to have a hard time winning them over. But we can also be creative in how we did it. Handing out an M&M CD or a pair of Reeboks to a young 16-year-old was infinitely more effective in my experience than sticking an M16 barrel in his face. There are a number of creative ways we can try to win those kids over and try to give us a fighting chance to succeed in Iraq.
What's happening with that school now? Do you know?
I have no idea. I know that when we pulled out of that area, another Army unit did not replace it. They pulled back into a forward operating base. So I know that my section of Adamiya has increasingly become violent. There's still an incredible number of mortar attacks and IED attacks in that area. I keep in touch with one of my interpreters who still lives in the area over email every few weeks, and he tells me it's worse. It's much worse than we were there, and it continues to get worse. So I really worry about how those kids are and how that school's doing.
Paul Rykoff's new memoir is called Chasing Ghosts. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Play to the End, a novel of psychological suspense by Robert Goddard, author of Hand in Glove. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, during National Foster Care Month, honoring those who are changing a lifetime for America's children in foster care. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, giving the Democratic response to President Bush's Saturday radio address on the first anniversary of the Mission Accomplished speech. We continue our conversation with Paul Rykoff. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the first and last novel by the late playwright Wendy Wasserstein. It's set in a post-9/11 Manhattan. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Rykoff, the founder and executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, IAVA. In 2003 and 4, Rykoff led an infantry platoon in Iraq for the U.S. Army National Guard. He's now an infantry officer in the New York Army National Guard. He describes the IAVA as nonpartisan and says he's registered independent. But on May 1, 2004, the first anniversary of President Bush's Mission Accomplished speech, Rykoff gave the Democratic response to the president's weekly Saturday radio address. I asked how that happened.
I had come home from Iraq, and I was ticked off. I really wanted America to understand the urgency of what was happening in Iraq and understand the needs of the soldiers coming home and understand about issues like body armor and the inadequate number of troops. And when I came home, I saw Janet Jackson's exposed breasts dominating the media. And I think that really, you know, it really got to me. And I wanted to find a way to push Iraq and push veterans' issues to the front of the American consciousness. And I reached out to the Bush administration and didn't get much of a response there. And I reached out to the Kerry administration and didn't get much of a response there either. And I gave a speech at my alma mater, Amherst College in Massachusetts, talking about the war and talking about my experiences. And a few weeks later, I got a call from the Kerry campaign, and they asked me if I'd like to do some radio. Initially, I thought they meant, you know, I could go on a radio show or two or talk about Iraq. And they said, no, we'd like to give you the opportunity to do the Democratic response to the president's weekly radio address. It's usually given by a congressman or a senator, so I thought they were jerking my chain. I didn't think this was at all possible. But I did it on my terms. I had complete control over what I said. I didn't endorse John Kerry, and I didn't really rail into President Bush. I just tried to represent the voice of the soldiers. And people may say I was used by the Democratic Party, but I used them. After that, I broke ranks with the Kerry campaign, and other veterans did as well, and we really started our own movement that became IAVA. So, you know, I went to the Kerry administration, I think, looking for a place that would understand me and look for a place that would elevate the discussion about Iraq, and I was disappointed. But I used that opportunity to thrust my issues and other veterans' issues into the national dialogue. It gave me a platform, and it was an opportunity that I saw I had to take advantage of. I didn't want to let that slide by because it would have taken much longer for these issues to come out. When I came home from Iraq, I was surprised that there weren't other veterans involved in the dialogue. 2004 was months after the war had begun, so I figured there would be veterans speaking on behalf of Bush or on behalf of Kerry or on behalf of themselves, and there was really a vacuum. And this was an opportunity that I saw, and I seized it, and I used it to demand accountability from the administration that still wasn't recognizing the severity in the insurgency, was still denying that we had an inadequate number of troops on the ground, that was still denying that there were body armor and Humvee armor problems, and I hope that speech at least moved the ball forward somewhat.
When you were working on the address that you gave as the Democratic answer to President Bush's radio address in 2004, you were warned that you might get court-martialed because you were still in the New York Army National Guard. And you were told that this kind of address by someone still in the National Guard was unprecedented. What were the concerns, and were you disciplined at all?
I wasn't disciplined, but there were a number of concerns, and I didn't know up until the day I gave the speech whether or not I would be court-martialed. We talked earlier about the fact that this is an all-volunteer army and the first time we fought a war with an all-volunteer army. Well, we're breaking new ground in the political sphere as well. When I gave that speech, people didn't know if I fell under the Hatch Act that applied to government employees. They didn't know if I was subject to the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or not. But after doing research and talking to a few JAG attorneys and scholarly people who understand these issues, they said that, you know, we really can't give you a definitive answer. Basically, they said, don't cross the line, but they couldn't tell me where the line was. So until I actually gave the speech, we didn't know if there were going to be legal repercussions for my giving the speech. But I was motivated, and I was really impassioned by the fact that I needed to do this, and I needed to represent the views. And I figured that the military would be smart, and the American people would support me, and in the end, it would work out. I really did have faith in people to stand behind me and understand that I wasn't saying anything that was damaging our country. I was saying something that would hopefully move the dialogue forward. And I looked at it through the same lens that I looked at a lot of things in the military. After every engagement, every exercise, every physical training session, we do an AAR, an after action review, where we sit down and talk about what went well, what went poorly, and what do we need to do differently next time. And that's what I saw this speech as doing, is trying to initiate a national AAR. And I still think, you know, 2 years later, we're only starting to have that real AAR. We're only really starting to analyze where we've gone wrong and how we can correct our mistakes.
Now, you were in Iraq when President Bush declared mission accomplished and said that the major combat operations in Iraq have ended. What was your reaction to the mission accomplished address then?
Initially, it was fury. It was really anger. And just, I was baffled. How could the president be standing on an aircraft carrier saying mission is accomplished when we're doing combat patrols and getting shot at in Baghdad? It just didn't make sense to me. And it really just rattled my head. I couldn't understand the audacity or the disconnect that would bring him to that point. The mission wasn't accomplished. We were still in Baghdad. We had a lot to do, and it didn't look like it was going to be accomplished anytime soon. So it looked like these guys were really detached with the battlefield, and they didn't understand how bad things were, and they didn't understand things were getting worse. And it was almost like this hopeful idea that they were going to will it into getting better. But I learned from one of my commanders on the ground that hope is not a course of action. We need a plan for success. So hoping the insurgency is going to go away and hoping the mission is going to be accomplished isn't going to get it done.
You were in Iraq when President Bush issued this warning to insurgents. He said, there are some who feel like the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is, bring them on. And that bring them on became a very famous phrase from President Bush. What was your reaction in Iraq?
I thought that was ridiculous. I mean, to taunt our enemy while you've got 150,000 troops on the ground is just ridiculous. I think it illustrated how little of an understanding the president had of the battlefield. And I think it illustrated how his advisors were really forcing him to be dangerously disconnected from the realities on the ground. To turn to your enemy and say, bring them on, is just a level of audacity that baffles my mind. It really was inappropriate, and it's some cowboy stuff you'd see in the movies. And you know, President Bush has never served on the ground, so maybe he doesn't have that immediate connection. Maybe he doesn't understand what soldiers are going through. But that's not the type of thing a soldier wants to hear when he's on patrol and thinking about his two kids and his wife back home. He doesn't want our president taunting our enemy, saying, bring it on.
But why not, in a way? I mean, you're supposed to be able to think, we can handle it. You know, whatever you do, we can handle it. We can secure the area. We can fight back. We can keep people safe.
Well, it's a level of arrogance that I think is unnecessary, and it sends a bad message to our enemies, and it also sends a bad message to the world. We don't need to be arrogant. We don't need to be boisterous. Just get the job done and let the results speak for themselves. I think we need to be humble about where we are and be honest about our progress. So to say bring them on is this cowboy mentality that I think really doesn't do us any good at all and sends a very bad representation of what America is to the world. Ultimately, you know, winning this war is not going to be a military affair only. The military is not going to be the sole solution to this problem. There needs to be diplomatic, there needs to be economic and political ways that we try to win the peace in Iraq. And to assume that we can just say bring it on is to assume that we can just push everybody over and we don't have to listen to anyone and we don't have to work with anyone or negotiate with anyone. And having been on the ground, I understand that Iraq is dominated by worlds of gray and it needs to be also dominated by negotiation and compromise.
My guest is Paul Rykoff, the founder and executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. His new memoir is called Chasing Ghosts. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Paul Rykoff, and he's written a soldier's memoir about his time in Iraq. It's called Chasing Ghosts. And Rykoff is also the founder of the group Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Explain something to me. When you went to Iraq, you were already very skeptical of the war, but you wanted to go.
Yeah. I wasn't convinced by the rationale, but at the same time, we didn't know. We didn't know that at the time that there were no weapons of mass destruction. So when I got on the plane, I said that George Bush had better be right because he was betting the house on the mother of all poker hands. He said there were weapons of mass destruction there, and I wanted it to be true. I didn't want to see our country with egg on their face. I didn't want to see our country be committing a catastrophic mistake that would jeopardize our standing in the world forever. And at the same time, I'm a soldier. So this is my job. My job is to try to lead a platoon in combat. It's what I signed up to do. And when the call comes and my generation is asked to go to war, I didn't want to be sitting on the sidelines. It's not that I'm hungry for combat, but it's kind of like practicing for a soccer game that never comes. When the game does finally come, you want to be in the game. You don't want to be sitting on the sidelines. So I hope that I could make an impact on the ground, even if the rationale for war turned out to be wrong, which it did, and things started to go badly. At least me and my platoon on the ground, my 38 guys, could make a difference. We could try to show the Iraqi people that Americans are good and that we do mean well, and our intentions, at least within that group, are good. And that's really what I sought to do when I went to Iraq. Because at the end of the day, even if I opposed this war, holding up a sign in Union Square or in Washington, D.C. wasn't going to stop the war. It was happening anyway. So I had to think about how I was going to make an impact on the ground to make a difference.
You are now in the National Guard. You're in the New York Army National Guard. So does that mean you could still be called up to serve a second time in Iraq?
Absolutely. I still go to drill on weekends, and I'll do 2 weeks this summer, and I'm subject to reactivation. And, you know, if that call comes, I'll shut my mouth, I'll pick up the rifle, and I'll go back on the line and do the job that I committed to do.
How would you feel about that?
I wouldn't be thrilled about it. My mother definitely wouldn't be thrilled about it. But you know, ultimately, my job is to lead those 38 guys and get them home alive, and try to do what we can to make good in the process. And I think I can do that. I can put my political opinions in my back pocket and try to execute the mission to the best of my ability. I think that's what a lot of soldiers are doing every day. I think a lot of the guys and girls who are over there right now are not thrilled about the mission, but they know they have a job to do. So when you're in the military and you're put on active duty, you put your political ideology and your personal opinions on the back burner until you're done with the mission. And at the same time, you're so busy trying to accomplish your mission and do your job that you don't have a lot of time to think about politics, and you don't have a lot of time to keep track of what's happening in Washington. So I think if I go back, I'll definitely be more than overwhelmed with the job at hand.
You know, I've heard the argument very strongly made by some veterans that some of the remarks, like some of the ones you've been making today that are very critical of the war in Iraq, are bad for the troops, because the troops are there, the troops are in jeopardy, the troops are doing their best. And to question or discredit the mission itself can't be good for the men and women serving in Iraq. As the head of a veterans' rights group, what's your response to that?
I think that's dangerous talk. I think that nobody has more of a right to talk about the way this country is going than somebody who's put their life on the line for it. You know, guys like me go halfway around the world to get shot at so that people back home can have these types of discussions. And a time of war is the most important time to question your government. And, you know, Mark Twain once said that I love my country over always and my government when it deserves it. I think that, you know, it's up to veterans to help inject their experience into this dialogue. They know what's going on the ground, and they're a lot like the average American. They're not some politician or a policy wonk, and they have very valuable understandings of what's happening in Iraq, and they've got to be involved in the conversation. This has happened in every generation. You know, going all the way back to the Revolutionary War and George Washington, veterans have served in combat and come home and educated the American people and become part of the dialogue and run for office. John McCain did it. Chuck Hagel's done it. John Kerry's done it. And these guys provide very, very important perspectives on this critical issue. So the troops are way too busy over there anyway. They're not worried about what John Murtha said or what Trent Lott said. They're worried about the IED that just blew up at the back of their convoy. So, you know, this talk of trying to, I think, intimidate people from dissent is really a dangerous precedent, and I think it's really unfounded with regard to the morale of the troops.
What are you hearing from veterans in your group about how their health care needs are being handled?
Well, we've got veterans in all 50 states, and I think the trend that we see overwhelmingly is that this country is not ready to receive the veterans coming home. We hear about increased wait times at the VA, a reduction in services, failure to assess and treat post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental health issues. And it's not just in one place. We're hearing more and more stories around the country. And you know, it shouldn't be a surprise. Every major veterans organization in the country, from the VFW to the Disabled American Veterans, has called on the Bush administration to fund the VA, more fully, to mandatorily fund the VA so the VA doesn't have to beg for scraps every year to fulfill their budget. So, you know, what we're seeing is that in many ways America is repeating the mistakes of Vietnam. We're seeing, you know, an increase in mental health issues, the divorce rates, suicides. Right now our organization is tracking 21 homeless Iraq vets in New York City. And according to the VA's own numbers, there are 400 nationwide. So I think we've made some progress from where we came from in Vietnam, but we've still got a long way to go. In the recent State of the Union address, the president never mentioned the word veteran once. Right now, it's just not a priority for him and his administration, and it needs to be, because after serving halfway around the world, these guys and girls deserve to be treated properly and taken care of when they come home.
But hasn't the president asked for a large, perhaps a record amount of increase in spending for veterans' health care for 2007?
Yes, he has, but it's not keeping up with demand. The percentage increase is not keeping up with the percentage increase of veterans and the percentage increase of strain on the VA services. It's also at a time where you've got thousands of World War II vets and Vietnam vets who are already straining the system, and now there's a new war with over 1 million people who are going to come home and seek services at the VA. The administration is playing Enron games with the numbers when it comes to the VA. They've been unreliable in their ability to project any statistic throughout this war, whether it was the insurgency, the amount of body armor, the number of troops. They've been wrong every time. And I'm here to tell you they're wrong again about veterans. They're downplaying the severity, and they haven't allocated enough money to take care of the people coming home.
Before you joined the Army, you were in investment banking. Can you just, like, go back to that time for us and tell us why you made such a big change going from investment banking to the military?
Well, I had joined the military before I went into investment banking. But when I went into investment banking, I was in the reserves and I was still drilling on the weekend. But it was definitely a culture shock between the two. I didn't enjoy being an investment banker. I got a lot out of it and I was paid well and I learned a tremendous amount about business. But, you know, my best day on Wall Street was still worse than my worst day in Iraq. I just didn't love it. And being in Iraq was the absolute opposite. It was something that I believed in leading men and being in the military was something that I felt was really teaching me a lot about myself and about my world. But it was definitely a contrast because I worked a few blocks from Ground Zero. And in all my time in investment banking, I never thought that we'd be attacked a few blocks away. And I never thought I'd have to make a shift from banker to soldier that quickly. So it really did serve as a shock to my system, I think, as long as in everyone else's, when 9/11 happened. And many people like myself were called on to switch their profession from citizen to soldier. Not just bankers, but bus drivers, teachers, and everybody else around the country who's in the National Guard and Reserve.
No, you said that your best day as an investment banker was worse than your worst day in Iraq, that you really believed in what you were doing in Iraq. But at the same time, you didn't believe in the larger mission of the war. So can you explain that seeming contradiction?
Yeah, I believed in being a soldier. And I believe that it's an honorable profession, and being in the military is something that our country needs people to do. You know, we need smart people, we need creative people, we need motivated people in our military, because, you know, ultimately soldiers don't choose which war they go to fight in. And if another attack comes, we need a strong military, and we need good people in that military. And I wanted to be a part of that, and I was proud to serve with 38 guys who were fantastic Americans and were great soldiers and good people. And I really enjoyed being around them. The camaraderie that you have in the military and the unity and the cohesion is like nothing else I've ever experienced. And I like being a soldier. I like being around the guys, and I like trying to do something for the betterment of our country. So, you know, it's a conflict in that the mission is obviously become more troublesome. But at the micro level, in my experience, being a platoon leader was the best job I ever had.
Well, Paul Rykoff, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. My pleasure.
Paul Rykoff is the founder and executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. His new memoir is called Chasing Ghosts.
Thank you.
Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews a new novel set in Manhattan after September 11th, written by Wendy Wasserstein, who died earlier this year. This is Fresh Air. When playwright Wendy Wasserstein died of cancer this past January at age 55, the lights on Broadway were dimmed in her honor. Her many plays, including The Heidi Chronicles, which won the Tony Award as well as a Pulitzer Prize, explored intelligent women coming to terms with feminism, careers, love, and motherhood. Wasserstein's debut novel, Elements of Style, has just been published posthumously, and book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
Ideally, a reviewer is supposed to regard a work of art on its own terms, divorced from the author's life. But I'm finding it impossible to clinically detach Wendy Wasserstein's debut novel from the context of her untimely death. With Ghoulish Mistiming, an advance copy of the novel, called Elements of Style, arrived in my mail just a few days after Wasserstein died. The pink cover touted the media appearances and radio interviews that Wasserstein would be doing as part of her anticipated big book tour. Too much loss, says a character in Elements of Style, reflecting on 9/11 as well as some fictional tragedies that the novel manufactures. Too much loss. Wasserstein's death was followed a few days later by Betty Friedan's. That's too many prominent feminists to lose in 1 year, let alone 1 week. Of course, Wasserstein was much younger and funnier than Friedan, but both women offered a grown-up vision of feminism that's largely absent from contemporary chick-lit-style fantasies. The heroines of post-feminist sagas, like Sex and the City, for example, may be sexually and financially liberated, but their adventures are retrofitted with fairy tale endings, complete with prince and comfy castle. Friedan and Wasserstein, in their different ways, told women the hard truth. "You're not going to get it all, sister," they said. "No one does. Grow up. Keep the faith. We've still got a revolution to figure out." In Elements of Style, one of Wasserstein's typical heroines, 40-ish, unmarried, Jewish, essentially feminist but wistful about other lifestyles, goes head-to-head with a bevy of high-society Stepford wives. Frankie Weissman is a pediatrician in New York, renowned as someone people can count on. But as Frankie Riley notes, quoting the pre-feminist wisdom of her stepmother, "Looking like someone you can count on never found anyone a husband." Because Frankie's office is deliberately located in the borderlands of Upper Fifth Avenue, she treats both the underprivileged and the ultra-privileged. But Wasserstein almost exclusively trains her wicked eye on the rituals of the rich and fatuous. Here, for instance, is how Wasserstein describes the post-9/11 emergency preparedness procedures adopted by one of the society mothers whose children are among Frankie's patients. Since 9/11, Judy Tremont had made a few obvious changes in her life. First of all, she never let her nannies take her children in taxis anymore. Any turban driver talking on a cell phone could be a terrorist. She kept a supply of iodine pills in her home, plus gas masks for the entire family and their pets. Every day she carried a Fendi emergency kit in her purse, neatly packed with Cipro and folding flat shoes. And perhaps the biggest change was she always wore her good jewelry in the event she'd have to trade it for easy passage off Manhattan. The plot of Elements of Style is figured like a square dance where Edith Wharton is the caller. The chic parents of Frankie's patients switch partners and twirl off into misalliances, and even Frankie herself gets drawn into a romance with a dermatologist separated from his gorgeous wife. But because he's the kind of society doctor who keeps his patients' butt fat in his office refrigerator so that he can inject it into their facial wrinkles, we canny readers know he's too shallow for the likes of Frankie. Her character is the most vivid presence in this clever but ultimately not very memorable novel. Consequently, like so many of Wasserstein's other excellent women, because Frankie is so much more substantial than everyone else around her, she's destined to make her way alone. Elements of Style gets decidedly darker as it goes on. Characters get sick, some die, and terrorists again attack New York City. And then, in the very last sentences of this novel, Wasserstein rallies and has Frankie usher a new infant life out of the hospital and off into the damaged city. It's the kind of qualified, hopeful ending worthy of Wasserstein, a writer with a comic, grown-up view of life, a woman too smart to ever willfully dumb herself down to peddle fairy tales.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Elements of Style by the late playwright Wendy Wasserstein. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the Roth Family Foundation for the NPR Endowment, helping to fund NPR's West Coast Production Center. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Maurice Sendak. He and playwright Tony Kushner have collaborated on a new stage adaptation of their book Brindabar, a Holocaust fairy tale. Also, Amy Sherman Palladino, the creator of the WB series Gilmore Girls. Palladino's about to leave the show. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.